Before I start, I'd like to acknowledge the Whadjuk Noongar Noongar custodians of this land that we meet on and pay respects to the elders past, present and emerging. Always when I come to a day, it becomes a choice of what to speak on. And my dad would say I need to speak on the lectionary, but that's sometimes I do that. I've been talking about Acts this year, but as I was coming up to today, I just had a recurring line in my head. Tell me about Jesus. Tell me about Jesus. What shall I speak on today? Tell me about Jesus kept coming up. But I was aware I hadn't finished the series on Acts because I've managed to talk about Acts without talking about Paul. Who, given that next to God, he's the main character in Acts, was quite an omission. So I had another read of Acts, and what I was really struck by was the repeat motive of Paul telling people about Jesus. So I'm picking up the theme of telling you about Jesus, starting from Acts 26 and leaping off from Paul. So if a sermon's not your thing today and you just want one question to mull around, my suggestion is that you sit with who's Jesus to you? And if you had a chance to summarise what you believe and why, what would you say? So Acts 26 is the last major speech in Acts. Acts has got lots of these big speeches, and this is the last one. So it's the climax, it's the culmination of Luke's presentation of the message of the early church. The context is that Paul was arrested in Jerusalem, where he was repeatedly told in visions if he went there he'd got arrested. So he went there and got arrested. And then the Jewish authorities wanted to kill him, so he claimed his Roman citizenship, which got him into the Roman legal system and protected him from the Jewish religious courts. He was in prison for a couple of years in Caesarea, and then there's a change of governor, and he's brought before the new governor, Festus. Isn't that a great name? If you were Governor Festus, would you expect anything good of yourself? Festus and King Herod Agrippa, and Agrippa's sister Bernice, and probably a whole lot of others. And chapter 26 is Luke describing this meeting. He uses the structure of a legal hearing to give Paul a stage, and then Paul presents a manifesto. He summarises who he is, why he's preaching, and what the guts of his message is. So, according to this Acts narrative, who Paul is a former violent religious fanatic who was used to be so enraged by perceived heresy that he pursued people to the death. He's a scrupulous keeper of the Torah as part of his being a Pharisee, but he's also a changed man. He's living a moral and upright life. He's an obedient servant of the one God, that's important, and maybe he's even a prophet. Why is he preaching? According to the story, because he met Jesus and Jesus told him to go and preach. It's as simple as that. And particularly to preach to people outside Judaism. And what is the guts of the message Paul is bringing? Again, according to Acts, the guts of the message is Jesus of Nazareth is the Jewish Messiah, Christ. He was rejected by his people and killed, but God raised him to life. This risen Jesus is the light, both for the Jewish people and also for the Gentiles. The Torah, the Jewish writings, prophesied all of this, that the suffering and risen Jesus would be the fulfillment of Jewish longing. So this is not a heretical new religion. Individuals are to turn from darkness to light and receive forgiveness. An acceptance of Jesus' resurrection and the gifts that are brought will bring people into the community of God, Jews and Gentiles together. And this is Israel's destiny. Is this Paul's Jesus? Or is this Luke's Jesus, Luke who wrote Acts? Or is this how Jesus of Nazareth might have seen things? Is this our Jesus? What shapes the way we talk about Jesus to each other and to others? And to ourselves, I think. One of the things is the audience. So within the story, the audience here is an elite audience. They're powerful and they're wealthy. And also Paul is negotiating for his life. This is perhaps not the forum to discuss the Magnificat about the mighty being torn down from their thrones. Although that piece is also written by Luke. That's in the Gospel of Luke, the other companion volume. So why would this editor of both the Gospel of Luke and Acts put in a scene pandering to the mighty if he really thought Jesus was going to tear them off their thrones? Perhaps Jesus is here presented as the one that all people are longing for and have been waiting for, not just some country bumpkin with a whole lot of illiterate hick followers, but someone worthy of discussion in high society. And perhaps if one who was dismissed during his life and put to a shameful death is now this powerful figure of light coming to Paul, the author might be putting in a subtle warning to elites that the overlooked might not stay overlooked. The second audience is not within the story, but it's the audience that the book of Acts was going to. And it specifically says at the start of Acts, "Dear Theophilus, I'm writing to you." Theophilus is probably a wealthy patron of Luke. So there's the context of the Theophilus reader. There's also probably a community around Theophilus, around Luke, of probably third generation Christians possibly needing some reassurance about their origins. Possibly they too have been accused of breaking either the civil or religious laws. So it's reassuring to them to have this story of the best advocate for Christian faith ever being put on trial and using Jesus as the defence. And he gets off. The note at the end's important. There is no case against this man. So later believers, therefore, can hold fast to this truth. If we hold fast to the truth of Jesus, we too can be acquitted of the claims brought against us. But again, the question, which truth? Which Jesus? The one in the Magnificat or the one in the flattery of Agrippa that starts this passage that Bevan read to us? The one that's here in the speeches we have of Paul, or of Luke's version of the speeches of Paul, or the things that Paul says in his letters, which are not quite the same? They're not wildly contradictory, but they're definitely different in influence, in emphasis, that's the word I want. Which Jesus we speak of and believe in and trust has a lot to do with who we are as people. So who are the people who are giving us Acts 26? Now, all the scholars claim that we've only got Luke's voice here. We can't know anything about Paul from Acts. It's all Luke. I think we have a combination. I think Paul was a vibrant person, and his influence on the Christian community just rippled out. So I think we have Luke's flavour telling us about this vivid Paul, and beneath both of them, an actual life of Jesus that was passed on in stories and traditions. Now, we don't know who Luke was. We can guess he was educated, which means he wasn't poor. We can guess he was Greek-speaking. He was probably from an urban setting. He was possibly not Jewish or not originally Jewish. He may have been a convert. He was writing for this wealthy patron, Theophilus. He probably shapes his message to draw the wealthy man who is his recipient into the story and into faith in Jesus. So the concluding words of Paul in this chapter, when he says, "Oh, I would hope that everyone would be as I am, except for the chains," these are almost certainly aimed at Theophilus, not at Agrippa. "I would hope that you, wealthy and powerful man reading this story, would become as I am and follow Jesus." Some of Luke's themes that we see reflected here in how Paul is talking about Jesus: God actively engaged with human history. That's a strong thing for Luke. So God reaches in and turns Paul around in a very vivid way. The Christians as a continuing people of God, not a new thing. So the insistence in this passage that Moses and the prophets foretold Jesus, he's the Jewish Messiah. The extension of God's community through Jesus to non-Jews, and resurrection as the core to all of that. That's very much Luke's theology and Luke's idea of Jesus and what Jesus means in God's world. And Luke very cleverly has Paul ask Agrippa, "You believe in prophets, don't you?" And Agrippa, seeing the ploy, carefully doesn't answer, because to believe in the prophets is not just to believe in something from the past, but to believe that prophecy is possible. And to believe that if God in our past spoke through fallible human messengers, God could do it again. And therefore, this Paul standing in Agrippa's court could be a messenger of God. What do we have to do to get you to accept that Paul is a messenger of God is part of the subtext here. And I think that's a good question for us. What does it take to convince us that someone is speaking truth about God? Are there still prophets amongst us? Would you trust one if you met one? And how would you know? We've got more clues about Paul than we do about Luke. Partly because we've got letters written by Paul, so we've got multiple sources. But in this passage, Luke has Paul give a concise biography. And the point of that in here is to show that he's trustworthy. He's always lived with absolute integrity, whatever it was he believed. Even if now he's saying he thinks his beliefs were wrong, his integrity is never in question. Nothing short of a direct encounter with the man who God has raised from death would change this man's mind. He's that one-minded, one-directional. But that's exactly what he claims has happened, that he has completely changed direction because he encountered the risen Jesus. That's the introduction that Luke gives, and that's an important introduction. But I also think there's things in the story that tell us about Paul and how Paul shapes Jesus that perhaps weren't part of what Luke was intending us to see necessarily. One is that Paul is elite. He's a Greek and a Roman citizen, and he's a Pharisee who had temple authority to be doing these things, like going to Damascus. Citizenship in this era is not an automatic thing. It's a social honour and it's a mark of status. So to have Greek and Roman citizenship and also be a Pharisee who's on the in with the temple, he's in high society. And though he's given much greater consideration within the Roman legal system, theoretically the Roman legal system gave everyone access to the courts, but that's just not true. It didn't happen. So the fact that he gets the chance to even present his case says that he is someone of social note. He probably didn't receive as harsh treatment in the prison system because of that. Now, Luke is talking up Paul's elite credentials because in Paul's letters, Paul talks them down. And Paul talks about his suffering and how he's endured violent punishment and imprisonment. But Luke is particularly showing us a man of the elite. So what I get from that is it's not that surprising that Paul can sometimes seem more distant from the kind of radical world-turning stuff of Jesus, the upside-down new order where the first shall be last and the poor shall inherit the earth. When Paul talks about following Jesus and how that means serving the poor, it can tend to sound more like charity than justice. And I think that's because Paul speaks as an outsider, but Jesus was poor and had no social position, so he spoke as an insider. Paul is a Pharisee. Luke wants us to know that. Paul wants us to know that in his letters too. He mentions that. One of the important things about being a Pharisee, other than that meaning that he's absolutely committed to a Jewish Messiah, is that he's got this intellectual way of approaching the world, and he must make sense of this new information that he's received about Jesus. And so out of that, we get this remarkable intellectual theology that is in Paul's letters, explaining how all this could possibly be, these things that don't seem at face value to go together. But it also means that Paul is predisposed to believe in resurrection. Because the Pharisees and the Sadducees were two big factions in first century Judaism, and the Sadducees adamantly didn't believe in resurrection, and the Pharisees adamantly did, and it was a point of conflict between them. And here in Acts, and in a couple of earlier passages in Acts, Paul deliberately plays up this by appealing to the Pharisees in the Jewish court by saying, no, no, I'm preaching resurrection, therefore I'm on your side. All of which is very interesting, but I think that gives us a sense of why resurrection is so central to the way the message is presented It's one of the core important things for a Pharisee to believe in resurrection. They didn't quite expect resurrection the way it turned out with Jesus, I have to say, but the idea of resurrection they were on board with. The other thing is that Paul works with Gentiles, and it's presented as he works with Gentiles because he's met Jesus and is sent out, but also his work with Gentiles influences how he sees Jesus and how he talks about Jesus and who Jesus is for him. That's more evident in Paul's letters than in Luke's accounts of Paul, but it's there, this idea that the things of the Gentiles, Greek and Roman culture even, and the ideas of thinking about God get into how he's thinking about God. But most importantly, Paul somehow encountered a living Jesus. He had an experience of revelation. And he talks about this in his letters too, although he doesn't pin it on the Damascus Road and there's not flashes of light and things. Luke tells us this story in Acts three times. Now, repeating something three times is a pattern for Luke. He does this when he wants you to really, really pay attention. He really wants you to make sure you don't miss that Paul met Jesus. He is telling us about Jesus because he personally met the risen Jesus. And depending on your theology, depends on what you get out of that. For some people, because Paul, as a murderer, met Jesus and was welcomed and forgiven and accepted, this is the underpinning for his theology of grace. He, in his violence, was met with love and forgiveness. So he therefore writes and understands that God's measure of relationship with us is love and forgiveness. For others, the important part of this is that he's sent to the Gentiles. Somehow in this encounter, out of it, he gets the idea that he must expand the mission to the Gentiles. And Acts 26 is one of the key pieces because it's of the three accounts of the Damascus Road, only in Acts 26 does it specifically say, Jesus says to me, go out to the Gentiles. It's linked into here. He comes in this blaze of light. The light's really important, so that then Paul can bring the Gentiles into that light. It's also, this encounter is also a thing that affirms Paul's identity and the work that he's doing. So that when he stands before Festus and Agrippa, or if it ever happened, before Caesar, nothing's going to sway him because he knows in his bones that he follows a true living God, that Jesus is alive, and that he's wanted and that he's involved in the work of a God who brings life out of death. So out of an encounter like this, Jesus is always going to be central for Paul. Everything comes out of that because he had some sort of an encounter with Jesus. Now, all of that's quite interesting. It might give you a lens for how you read stories. But the important thing for me out of this is, how do I talk or think about Jesus? What is it I bring that shapes the Jesus that I encounter? And what is it about the people I talk to, which is mostly you, that shapes the way I share Jesus? Paul, as a Pharisee, predisposed to believe in resurrection, had an encounter with the living Jesus and understood that in the language of resurrection. What are the things that are in me, if I am to encounter God, that shape how I understand what happens? Now, I've never had a dramatic encounter with the risen Jesus. And because Christian culture can have a sort of a culture around that, that that's an important transformative experience, it becomes a context in itself that I haven't. I am one of the non-encounterers. So how does that shape my Jesus? I'm a highly educated and intellectual white woman of reasonably comfortable income. I've never felt really hungry. I've never been afraid for my own safety. I've never worried about where I would sleep. Do I understand the Jesus spoken to Agrippa better than I understand the Jesus spoken to a lame man whose name nobody remembers except Jesus. Am I more inclined to be interested in a Jesus of personal transformation than societal overthrow because I'm comfortable? Because of my intellect and the way I like thinking about the world, am I looking for a Jesus who is subtle and nuanced and needs plenty of consideration rather than a Jesus who's direct and immediate and pragmatic? Who is the Jesus that you know? And who is the Jesus that you long for? Who is the Jesus you speak to others? Are there differences between the answers to those questions? Are there things, perhaps, that you no longer believe? Today I'm not so much telling you about Jesus as asking you, please tell me about Jesus. Tell me about your Jesus, the one in whom you've found rest or identity or challenge, the Jesus that you love. Or maybe that you fear, that you trust, or who confuses you. So over the next few months, I would really love to have a whole lot of you up here sharing about your Jesus and helping us understand what has formed that Jesus experience and understanding for you. And I'd also like you to consider challenging yourself to look at other views very different from your own. And that may be an understanding of Jesus that you was the church culture you grew up with that you've walked away from. Or it may be maybe someone from a very different culture, maybe someone from a different level of income, someone from a very different theological stance. Listen to some people who are not like you and see what you hear of Jesus in their voices. This week, I'm going to invite you to take some time to revisit what has formed your faith in Jesus. And that could be just rereading the old stories. It might be having a conversation with someone who mentored you. It might be sitting with the memory of a person or a place or an event that shaped you. Take time this week to revisit and to celebrate all those things that have formed you. And also take time to notice the context in those experiences and how that may have shaped what you took home from them. Just as Paul's Jewishness and social privileges influenced what he took from his encounter with Jesus, and Luke's patron Theophilus influenced how he wrote about him. 2,000 years ago, an unglamorous Jewish peasant, as we say in the godly place stories, did such wonderful things and said such amazing things that people followed him. If you were close enough, you would have seen the children roll their eyes when I said that line because they know it so well. Some loved him, but some hated him and had him killed. But those who loved him became convinced that God had raised him from dead. Something happened that changed everything. And so the stories were told and retold, transforming people generation after generation, reformed for new times and passed on like the box inside the box inside the box until they have reached us. The stories of Jesus have shaped us, and our experiences have shaped our stories of Jesus. And now it's our turn to pass those stories on. So from all that, I'm inviting you to tell me about Jesus. Right this minute, I'm inviting you, if you have any questions or comments, you can tell me about Jesus in the next 3 months. But would anyone like to?
Claire, do you see how much discontinuity, given that both Luke and Acts are addressed to Theophilus, I think, do you see between the Jesus of the Sermon on the Plain and the Paul's Jesus? Because Paul's Jesus kind of irritates me. I'm irritable, you know. The Jesus of the Sermon on the Plain, seeing it's written by the same guy, and the fact that sometimes I don't see very much of the Jesus of Luke's gospel in the Jesus of Paul. And I was in my more conspirational moments and reading about the Ebionites and all that sort of stuff, wondering how much Jesus is really in Paul.
I think one of the things is that Paul uses a really different language than the gospel writers. I mean, they're both writing in Greek, but the way Paul uses language is very, very different. If you read Paul with the intention of using his language to explain what's happening in the Gospels, there's a lot of parallels. So, for example, if the language of justification and righteousness is language for the kingdom, for example, then a lot of Paul's letters become about the kingdom and about things that often are seen as only in the Gospels. The Sermon on the Plain is really interesting because that's in Luke. And the Sermon on the Plain is harsher than the Sermon on the Mount because the Sermon on the Plain also has the curses as well as the blessings. And yet that's addressed to Theophilus. So Luke was prepared to lay it out there, particularly in his gospel. It tapers down a bit in Acts, in my opinion, how full he is about challenging wealth and cultures of wealth. I also think the letters we've got of Paul, it's never Paul standing up and saying, I'm going to tell you what I believe. It's in response to stuff going wrong, generally. So it's narrow. It becomes, this is how the thing I believe is going to apply over here to this little piece. And sometimes that skews then what's in the big thing. Paul doesn't, in his letters, quote Jesus really very much at all. But I read a study this week that looked at allusions to Jesus and the direct quotes and made quite a convincing case that Paul quite clearly knew the stories and the works of Jesus, but that wasn't what he was talking about specifically when he was writing his letters, so he didn't feel the need to just quote and quote and retell that story. He was writing to people who he assumed knew that and then was trying to answer this question that was causing conflict. That doesn't solve all the problems. There are differences, but possibly there's a difference. Paul was clearly an irascible character who just got up people's noses because he had no social skills and he would just say what he thought and boom, just run all over people. Whereas the gospel writers, I think, tried a bit harder to present things in a way that was appealing. And Paul, because of Paul's story, even the stories in Acts, which are trying to make Paul into a hero, even in Acts, they can't get away from the fact that he causes trouble. So there's that sense too that if you were to meet Paul, I think he might not have had many friends, and that if we read his letters as if he was a warm, cuddly person who we'd love to have for dinner, we'll probably wonder why he's on such a different page to the Gospels. But if you read him as that one person who's totally driven and passionate about the thing that we do all kind of agree on, but gee, we probably wouldn't say it quite like that, then maybe you can hold him a bit differently. Yeah, David Attenborough meets the Green Socialist Aggressive Party. Thanks, Paul. Yeah, the Gospels have been more the David Attenborough version for a long time. Not the Gospels are hard-hitting things, but David Attenborough's most recent thing, he's suddenly become a bit of a Paul about, you know, we've actually got to change the world now. We've actually got to do something or we're all going to die, taking on climate change quite dramatically. Yeah, same story, different style. Nobody else. All right. I can never put answers, Gail, but I'll work on questions. Yeah, no, I will. I'll pull the questions out and I'll put them. Next week we actually have a service which has got small groups, and one of the options for those small groups will be to pick up some of the questions from today and have a look at them. There'll be a few other options as well if that's not something you want to do, but so that'll be next week. You can pick that up. Okay, thank you.